evil face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for knots, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, November 21st, 2012. 150 Palestinians killed by Israeli bombardment targeting Gaza as attacks enter its eighth day and protests continue all over the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israel's continued military attacks on Gaza entered its eighth day. The Palestinian Health Ministry in the coastal region announced that 150 Palestinians were killed and some 1,300 others were injured by the Israeli aerial, sea and ground bombardment. The Israeli military has reported dropping over 100 bombs on Gaza overnight on Tuesday and into Wednesday, including government buildings and media offices. The Abu Khadra government building in Gaza City was hit repeatedly, and the headquarters of the Agence France-Presse in Gaza City was also bombarded. The Al Jazeera office in Gaza City was also damaged, and Press TV reported that its correspondent, Akram Al-Shatari, was injured. Meanwhile, Israeli media sources reported Wednesday that 21 Israelis have been injured in an explosion that took place on Wednesday afternoon in a bus in Tel Aviv. One of the wounded is in serious conditions. According to initial reports, two men threw a bomb at a bus near the Israeli Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. No further information was provided and no Palestinian group claimed responsibility. In the West Bank today, hundreds of Palestinian youth held a massive protest against U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who visited the central West Bank city of Ramallah and held a meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Protesters were angered by Clinton's comment yesterday in Tel Aviv when she said that Israel have the right to defend itself. In other places in the West Bank, and for the eighth day in a row, local youth continued to protest and clash with Israeli troops at the Israeli war surrounding the West Bank and nearby Israeli military checkpoints. K Clashes were reported around Ramallah City, Central West Bank, Nablus and Jenin in the north, as well as Bethlehem and Hebron, Southern West Bank. Soldiers responded by firing tear gas, chemical water and live ammunition. Muhammad was one of the youth protesting near the wall in Bethlehem.
The situation here is very, very dangerous. All of us here go with, on demonstrations to help other families and brothers and sisters in Gaza. All of us are Palestinian. We are one hand together.
Meanwhile, inside West Bank cities, activists continue to organize sit-ins and prayers in solidarity with Gaza. Abdel Fattah Abusroor is one of the organizers.
With all this violent aggression against Gaza and the bombardment with Israeli missiles all over, we are here with our children to go and show our solidarity with our own people and say that we are with them. And what is happening in the West Bank is complementary to what is happening in Gaza. We refuse to be silenced and we refuse to be just simple observers on what is happening.
Near the Israeli wall in Bethlehem City, as night falls, clashes continued, as is the case in many other Palestinian cities. Protesters say they are not going to stop until the Israeli attacks on Gaza stops. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, November 21st news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Update, update, update. As of 4:30 p.m. on the 21st of November, a ceasefire has been announced between Israel and Gaza. The terms of the ceasefire require Israel to lift the siege of Gaza and end the blockade. Within 24 hours, the borders of Gaza are supposed to be open. Once again, direct action gets the goods.
The latest dangerous escalation of violence between Israelis and Palestinians began on November 14th after Israel carried out some 50 airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, one of which targeted and killed the Hamas government's military commander, Ahmed Jabari. The government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stated that the assault, in response to days of rockets fired from Gaza into Israeli territory, was the beginning of a broader offensive to destroy the Hamas military's capability to launch long-range missiles that can reach Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Hamas responded to the Israeli airstrikes by launching hundreds more rockets into Israel, many of which were destroyed in midair by Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. The deployment of tens of thousands of Israeli troops on the Gaza border in preparation for a possible ground invasion threatened to provoke a broader war similar to the Israeli assault on Gaza in 2008-2009 that led to the deaths of 1,400 Palestinians and 13 Israelis. As the death toll in Gaza exceeded 130 on November 20th, newly elected Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi was attempting to broker a ceasefire between the two sides with support from the U.S. and other nations in the region. While Israel is demanding a halt to all rocket fire from Gaza, Hamas insists on an end to Israel's land, sea, and air blockade of Gaza in effect since June 2007. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project, who examines the chronology of events and the continuing siege of Gaza, which led to the latest conflict between Israel and Hamas.
History starts with when you start the clock. So we could say that this escalation started, and this is now how most of the U.S. press is reporting it, that it started with the Israeli assassination of the Hamas leader Ahmed Jabari on November 14th. That would be accurate because that assassination followed a two-day rather fragile but still holding ceasefire that was in effect between Israel and the Palestinians, between Israel and Hamas. Or you could go back further, because there had been a great deal of violence across the border in the week prior to that. You could start with the Palestinians having fired on an Israeli patrol with tanks and a jeep at the border on the 8th of November. But then if you ask the question, well, why did they fire? Well, it turns out that morning the Israelis had shot and killed a Palestinian man who was mentally disabled, mentally challenged. They claim, well, we yelled at him to get away from, to leave the fence. It was in response to that Palestinians shot at Israel. You could go back and forth and back and forth on that and pick any day you want and say that's the day we start the clock. But the important thing, I think, Scott, is that all of this takes place in the context of occupation. And people immediately come back and say, wait a minute, how can you say that it's occupied? The soldiers and the settlers pulled out in 2005. Absolutely true. But what that doesn't say is that occupation continued, because occupation in international law means control by another government outside. Not it has to be X number of soldiers on the ground at any given moment. It means that Gazans do not control their own airspace. Israel bombed their airport and controls the skies. Gaza does not control the seas off its own coast. The Israeli Navy does, and it prevents Gaza fishermen from going more than 1 mile out to sea. Gaza does not control its own borders. Israel determines who is allowed into Gaza and who's allowed to come out. It doesn't control its own exports and imports. All of that is controlled by Israel. Gaza remains occupied. It's a different form of occupation. It's in the form of a siege rather than in the form of a physical soldier occupation. But it's occupation nonetheless, and unless we understand it in that context, it's going to happen again, even when we get a ceasefire, because there will be a ceasefire, hopefully immediately, but there will be a ceasefire. The question is, will it last, or will it just be one more step towards the next escalation of violence? Because as long as there is this kind of siege imposed where people have no option, there's going to be violence.
Phyllis, in the battle for public opinion during this conflict, there's a lot of statements from Israel which I think are accepted by a majority of the American public. When Israel says there's no moral equivalence between Hamas deliberately targeting Israeli civilians and Israel's targeting Hamas military installations with precision weaponry with the occasional civilian casualty, although, of course, we know now there's been more than 100 civilians killed to date. But tell us, what's your view on this battle for public opinion that includes this kind of moral equivalence discussion?
I think we have to go back to the question of international law. The Palestinians in Gaza are an occupied population. That means they are to be a protected population with rights guaranteed by the Geneva Conventions of what happens to a population caught up in a war zone. That includes things like prohibiting disproportionate military attack. That doesn't mean that it has to be proportionate in the sense that if Hamas sends a rocket, we send a rocket. That's not the kind of proportionality that the law talks about. It means proportionate in the sense that the risk of killing people or injuring people in the neighborhood, the civilians that surround it, must be worth the gain. So that even if you think that your bomb is going to kill this one guy that you think might someday carry out a military attack against Israel, but the cost of that is going to be killing 20 children, that's disproportionate, and you can't do it. Even if there's a value to you, it's disproportionate, and it's the price is too high, essentially. That's what we're looking at right now. It's an even-if scenario. I mean, the reality is it comes back again to occupation. Why are there ever any rockets fired from Gaza into Israel? It's because people in Gaza are desperate, because the world has ignored them. As the world has taken up the call of the UN for the, quote, responsibility to protect in Libya and in Syria, not very well, I'm not proposing that those methods have worked, but they've at least taken up the understanding that the international community has some responsibility for people whose lives are being destroyed by a government that has power over them and over whom they have no influence. It's precisely what happens with foreign occupation. military occupation, which is what the Palestinians of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza face. The international community, the UN, the governments of the UN, have refused to do their part. Global civil society has come together with strategies like the movement for boycott and divestment and sanctions as a way of bringing nonviolent pressure to bear to stop the Israeli violations. But in the meantime, people are suffering enormously. And as long as that's the reality, there's going to be this kind of lashing out, unfortunately, with rockets that are terrifying.
That was Phyllis Menes, director of the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project. She is the author of 8 books, including the newly revised edition of Understanding the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, a primer. For more analysis and commentary on the Gaza conflict, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Update, update, update. As of 4:30 p.m. on the 21st of November, a ceasefire has been announced between Israel and Gaza. The terms of the ceasefire require Israel to lift the siege of Gaza and end the blockade. Within 24 hours, the borders of Gaza are supposed to be open. Once again, direct action gets the goods. The International Middle East Media Center is quoting a high-ranking Israeli official as reporting that Palestinian fighters have removed warheads from some rockets so as to reach deeper into Israel and set off air raid sirens in places like Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv residents have not had incoming rockets since the Scuds in the first Persian Gulf War. The unarmed rockets carry no explosives and can only cause damage by a direct hit, like an old-fashioned cannonball. Their main purpose is to trigger the sirens and drive the war home to Tel Aviv to the extent possible. Needless to say, removing a 33-pound explosive warhead does wonders for the range and velocity of a rocket like the Qassam 3. The Iron Dome air defense system actually strengthens this mode of attack by destroying the evidence that the rockets were unarmed. The lack of warheads combined with Iron Dome reduces the risk of bad publicity from a hit on a school or other sensitive civilian target. Back in the late 1990s, the IRA fired disarmed mortar shells into Heathrow International Airport when peace talks needed a nudge, but civilian casualties were deemed an unacceptable risk. Update, update, update. As of 4:30 p.m. on the 21st of November, a ceasefire has been announced between Israel and Gaza. The terms of the ceasefire require Israel to lift the siege of Gaza and end the blockade. Within 24 hours, the borders of Gaza are supposed to be open. Once again, direct action gets the goods.
On the 16th of November, at a Palestinian rally in front of the White House, demanding an end to Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip in occupied Palestine, one of the speakers, someone who has been to Gaza himself, told a chilling tale of just how bad Israel's siege of Gaza really is, with even wheelchairs being barred from entry into the besieged Gaza Strip.
I just want to say, in closing, that I've been to Gaza. I went to Gaza right after Operation Cast Red. We brought in hundreds and hundreds of wheelchairs because there were so many amputations. People who lost their legs from the white phosphorus, from the munitions that were designed to maim instead of kill. And the Israeli blockade would not allow in wheelchairs for the children and the elderly who had lost their legs. So I've seen Gaza firsthand. I've seen the suffering. I've seen the pain. But what I have to tell all of you here is that what I saw was broken bodies, but never a broken spirit. Today!
Update, update, update. As of 4:30 p.m. on the 21st of November, a ceasefire has been announced between Israel and Gaza. The terms of the ceasefire require Israel to lift the siege of Gaza and end the blockade. Within 24 hours, the borders of Gaza are supposed to be open. Once again, direct action gets the goods.
Afghanistan, 18th of November. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 20th of November. Gunman killed the driver of a NATO supply truck in northwest Pakistan on the Afghan border, according to officials. Afghanistan, 18th of November. The Taliban executed a man in Ghazni province claiming he was spying for NATO forces. Afghanistan, 20th of November. French troops have pulled out of Afghanistan except for 500 trainers. Country by country, the coalition is being whittled down. Afghanistan, 20th of November. A cop with the Afghan National Police was killed and another wounded when the Taliban raided their police post in Helmand province. Two of the attackers were killed as well. Afghanistan, 20th of November. A suicide bomber wearing a security guard's uniform set off his explosives near a NATO base in Kabul's heavily fortified diplomatic district on Wednesday, killing two Afghan security guards and wounding two government officials. The Taliban took credit for the blast, saying a CIA office was a target. A passing NATO vehicle took shrapnel hits but no injuries. Quote, all ISAF bases in the green zone are secure, a government spokesman claimed after the incident had ended, but we've all heard that before in Iraq. Mr. Barack Obama, George Bush couldn't win in Iraq, and you can't win anything in Afghanistan. Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
A week before Black Friday, the launch of the Christmas shopping season, Walmart warehouse workers in California went on a one-day strike to protest growing harassment at Walmart's supply hubs and retail outlets. For the first time in its 50-year history, Walmart faces widespread labor unrest and protest by a number of union-supported groups complaining about work conditions. Seafood workers were the first to walk out in June. In early October, Walmart workers in 12 states launched a one-day strike, and 200 workers crashed a Walmart shareholders meeting in Bentonville, Arkansas. The momentum will continue with labor protests on Black Friday, fueled by anger at the giant retailer for opening its doors on Thanksgiving evening, spoiling the holiday for many workers. The striking workers belong to a number of groups, including Organization United for Respect at Walmart, or Our Walmart, and Warehouse Workers for Justice. They are not seeking union recognition, but action on poor working conditions and a halt to the harassment of activists. Workers have the right to strike over unfair labor violations, a right Walmart has recognized. Historically, Walmart has taken a very hard line against unions. When Texas meat cutters won a union election in 2000, Walmart eliminated that position in all its stores. With low wages and a weak company-sponsored health insurance plan, families of California's Walmart workers are 40% more likely than other retail workers to rely on publicly funded health care and be eligible for public assistance.
On the 18th of November, thousands of activists organized by Bill McKibben marched from the Warner Theater to the White House carrying a gigantic inflated pipeline demanding that Mr. Barack Obama keep his promise to block the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline.
Barack Obama, yes we can!
Stop the dirty pipeline!
A few of the kind of political types at the White House who might have hoped that we might sort of forget about the Keystone Pipeline over the last year. We did not forget. We did not forget. It was a year ago that they said they were going to stop and do more study. And as I sit inside, the most interesting thing about the last year was that they got a lot of help in that study from Mother Nature. This was the hottest 12 months in American history. This year saw an epic drought across this country. This year saw the Arctic melt like nobody's business. This year saw that tragic and horrifying superstorm Sandy. Mother Nature has filed her comment. She does not want any more carbon in the atmosphere, and that starts with the Keystone Pipeline.
Some of the worst impacts of the existing Alberta tar sands mining project has been on Indigenous people living around the project whose children are being poisoned by water pollution. The Lakota Nation stands directly in the path of the pipeline. They have compared it to the railroad, a comparison which from the Lakota's perspective can only mean it's being regarded as a declaration of war. One of the speakers at Bill McKibben's rally after the massive march around the White House was from the Chippewa Nation.
Is that there's deaths going on in Alberta. There's with this Keystone XL pipeline, they're proposing to go through cultural historical lands that are going to decimate graves, sacred sites, and everything else. What they will do, what they're going to do is basically just go through and just say, we don't care about your land. You know, I've worked with Bold Nebraska quite a bit down in Nebraska, and I've always put in there saying the landowners in Nebraska, in Oklahoma, in Texas, anywhere along this line, they are the modern day Indians, in that their land is being taken from them and then giving them pennies on the dollar what it's worth, and they're just having to say, okay, we're going to take it. That's the way ancestrally this whole U.S. has been taken over.
I never thought I'd live to see the day that any Native American speaker would compare ranchers in the U.S. West to, quote, modern-day Indians. Yet, with land being stolen from ranchers in Texas and ranchers all the way up and down the pipeline in line to have their land taken by eminent domain, the comparison is an apt one, and that just goes to show you just how bad the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline really is. On the other hand, don't let anybody tell you you can't fight City Hall, and sure as hell don't let anybody tell you you can't fight TransCanada. Phase 4, the northern leg of the pipeline, which has to cross the border with Canada, has been dead in the water since the civil disobedience protests in front of the White House in August and September 2011 as Hurricane Irene came through.
You know what? When we started 18 months ago, the National Journal took a poll of its energy insiders, and 91% of those people, lobbyists, people on the Hill, 91% said that TransCanada was going to have their permit by this time last year. Okay? So far, we've stopped them for a year. That's 900,000 barrels a day. I'm not a good enough mathematician to tell you how much, except that it's a lot of oil that so far you've kept from spewing into the atmosphere, okay?
Mr. Barack Obama, don't think that just because the election has come and gone, you can forget about environmentalist voters. If you turn around and approve the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, no environmentalist voter will ever vote for a Democrat again. And I don't need to remind you what that says about the 2014 midterm elections, much less the 2016 elections. Not only that, Mr. Barack Obama, if you don't stop the pipeline, the people living in the path of the pipeline will. The blockade in Texas of the Phase 3 southern leg of the tar sands pipeline has been going on for 2 months. There was a massive day of action against the pipeline on the 19th of November. And here in D.C. on the 19th of November, Chesapeake Earth First did a solidarity action for that blockade by hanging a banner in the outside overhangs of the Canadian Up it goes. Straight up. This banner is in solidarity with the tar sands blockade blocking construction of Phase 3 of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. The wind is striking the lights. The Canadian embassy was a backup target. The original plan was to hang the banner inside the tall inside atrium of Bryan Cave LLP, a notorious law firm that represents TransCanada in pipeline cases. I wouldn't be surprised if some of these pipeline cases include the eminent domain cases in Texas, given that these guys were awarded Texas Lawyer of the Year in 2012. Here's a report on a failed attempt to deploy the banner inside Bryan Cave LLP.
Bryan Cave, we used the approaching crowd for distraction, also had somebody doing distraction. We managed to slip past the security guard they had outside. We got in, did the balloon release. Balloons didn't quite make it up. We got rushed by another security guard.
And so you yanked the balloons down so they could be reused?
Yeah, we did manage to reuse the balloons and put them up into the Canadian embassy, which was our plan B.
This was just one of the many solidarity actions for the tar sands blockade that took place between the 14th and the 19th of November 2012. On the 19th of November, the Nacogdoches Native American tribe and supporters, numbering about 40 people in all, shut down two construction sites of the southern leg of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline for the day. When it was over, seven activists were charged with bogus, trumped-up felonies, and several activists, including a 75-year-old Nacogdoches elder, had been pepper-sprayed for locking themselves in construction equipment. One of the pepper-spraying cops now finds he is shunned in his community. Construction crews gave up and left by 9:10 a.m., effectively ending work for the day at both targeted sites. These blockades were in addition to the two-month-long tree sit obstructing Keystone XL construction elsewhere in Texas. Here are some testimonials from a Why We Blockade video concerning the November 19th mass actions.
I had once hoped that maybe once Wall Street actually flooded and once they had to literally bail it out with buckets instead of with money, and they did, I thought that maybe the people with power would wake up and do something, but it's clear that that's not happening and we need to get in there and interpose ourselves into the gears of the machine and prevent this thing.
The more I learn about the pipeline, the more devastating I can see it's going to be for the future of our country, for the future of the world, actually, and all the damage that's already being done in Alberta and on down the line and the dangers to our waters. This is an incredible disaster in the making.
I feel passionately about this because I witnessed the destruction that tar sand oils can create. 100,000 gallons of tar sand oils were spilled in the Kalamazoo River, the river that flowed through my backyard as a kid, that I swam in, that was on the verge of recovery after decades of pollution. I refuse to sit idly by and watch this happen again.
I came down from Seattle to help block or prevent the tar sands pipeline from being built because it's an opportunity where people are actually trying to stop something physically.
I recently saw the devastation of Hurricane Sandy firsthand, and I saw how poor people and marginalized people were the most affected by that storm. And as an environmental scientist, I understand that if we do not stop this pipeline, if we burn this oil, then for something like Sandy to happen every single year for the next 50 years would be a wildly optimistic scenario.
I'm participating in the tar sands blockade because I feel that what's happening right now is wrong. We're destroying our forests, we're destroying our waters, we're poisoning our air, and we're basically leaving nothing left for future generations, for any species, not just our own.
During the November 19th blockades of Keystone XL construction, one cop recklessly threatened to cut safety lines at the tree blockade of one of the two construction sites that were shut down for the day. He also tried and failed to scare activists into turning the camera away from his abuses and threats.
You see this flag right here?
Mm-hmm. They'll arrest you for criminal trespass over there.
Over on the other side?
Yeah.
No, they're not. They're going to cut.
Who's cutting them? Who's cutting them?
They're putting their life in me.
What's your name, sir?
Okay.
Hey, guys,
everybody come up here.
You're the spokesperson for this group.
Okay. Everybody come on up here.
You can get this done if you choose to.
Yes.
I cannot make it twisted.
All right, everybody, come on.
You've asked them what they
come on. I'm not, this is not playing time, guys.
You've asked them, and they don't want to come down, so.
Do this the right way. Come down and get this done the right way. Turn the camera around. You are illegally photographing me. Turn the camera around.
Illegal. You're a public servant. You can be photographed.
Guys, come down. We know where this is going today.
This worker behind you is on private property. Does he have permission to be here?
He has my permission to be here. We've got 10 minutes.
10 minutes, guys. Y'all can help us resolve this, if you would, because...
What can I? What can we do?
I think we've tried. Yeah.
It's not going to help anything. I'm just telling you, the lines are going to be cut. Yeah.
All right. Well. So again, these are high tension lines. All of their weight and those platforms are on those lines.
I hope they've got some backups because they're fixing to cut the lines.
They do not. And if you, they do not. And if you cut the lines, you're putting their lives in extreme danger. And you'll be on video. It'll go right on YouTube, and you'll be the one liable.
I'm not going to be the one cut, but you're the one responsible for it.
We're responsible for ourselves.
We tried to reason with him.
In the end, that reckless cop had to back off. After all, construction crews had gone home for the day anyway. Guess he was worried this would be the start of a second permanent blockade, like the 2-month-old tar sands blockade that is still hobbling construction elsewhere in Texas. Don't try to bluff the tar sands blockade. We're talking Texas, and your bluff will surely be called.
Occupy Wall Street and related groups through InterOccupy have taken on a major relief effort called Occupy Sandy in the wake of the superstorm that hit the East Coast in late October. Volunteers in the New York City area coordinated their efforts from two central hub sites in Brooklyn and fanned out all over the city. They assisted people in neighborhoods that were without power and heat some more than 2 weeks after the storm hit, as the November days grew colder and darker. Another dimension of Occupy's Hurricane Sandy relief work was the building of bridges between the movement and diverse communities, where discussions turned to politics and economics. Many people in the communities impacted by the storm and Occupy organizers reached common ground in thinking about the urgent need to address climate change that produces dangerous storms like Sandy, as well as concern that developers may soon move to convert storm-damaged affordable housing units on the shoreline into luxury homes or expensive condominiums. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Pablo Benson Silva, the coordinator of one of two Occupy hub sites in Brooklyn. He talks about how the relief effort was organized, the role of social media, the massive scale of the all-volunteer-run organization, and the connection between standing up to the 1% and standing up to storms made more devastating by climate change.
Our job here is to make sure we match drivers with volunteers and supplies and take it out to different sites that we've opened and the most affected areas. Right now that we're talking about Far Rockaway, Coney Island, Staten Island, Sheepheads Bay. These areas, I just went out yesterday to Far Rockaway and they're just devastated. The destruction, the scale of it is pretty overwhelming. So as the week has progressed, we've been opening up new sites closer to underserved communities. Right now, the big kind of story coming out is that both FEMA, Office for Emergency Management, Red Cross, all these kind of institutional disaster relief players have been kind of dropped the ball. And we as a kind of makeshift network of non-paid volunteers have actually outrolled a network that has rivaled their response. We've been able to get aid volunteers, cleanup crews out into these most devastated areas very quickly. And I think it has a lot to do with kind of social media savvy of the Occupy movement brings to the equation and just kind of the enthusiasm and capacity to do multitasking and being at the same time compassionate, right? And kind of community building experience that Occupy brings to the equation. So Yeah. So far, it's been amazing, the response in terms of volunteers, that aren't necessarily affiliated with Occupy. People have just been are very anxious to help in any way possible. And the good thing about Occupy is that we've been able to figure out how volunteers can, through just quick orientations and kind of self-motivation and initiative, can do very meaningful work in this relief effort. Occupy manages two distribution sites. Need assessments we do with our branches on the ground. We send out volunteer supplies and drivers on a daily basis. I would say during the weekend is when we get most of our volunteers this weekend. We probably process through this site alone close to 5,000 volunteers. And I can't even count the cars. We're finally taking track of all this so that we have a better idea of how we're scaling gradually, because this has just been kind of ad hoc operation so far.
Well, is anybody, I mean, I know you're a famously, Occupy is a famously, non-hierarchical organization, but is there anybody in charge, or is it a pyramid, or is it just totally, horizontal?
So I think the way it's worked actually is it's been a kind of organic structure that has emerged based on need. I think one of the amazing things about this movement, this operation, is that it's a real meritocracy. Anybody who can bring a broad skill base and who has time to commit to this operation, extended period of time, immediately gets plucked as for organizing and coordination. So yes, obviously we have organizers and coordinators, but it's a kind of step up, step down approach, right? Where people don't get too comfortable in organizing positions, and they're moved around frequently. So there's a lot of turnover. I mean, people have other responsibilities besides this hurricane relief, right? And so we're always constantly switching out coordinators or constantly switching out. So yeah, I mean, that's one of the amazing things. You can say Occupy is a leaderless, but you can also say it's a leaderful movement, right? And we kind of encourage people to take initiative, and people with leadership skills immediately find a space for themselves here.
I'm staying with some friends my friend has a friend who has a brother who's a what do you call those trader people on Wall Street? He's setting up his own thing with his own money and, getting volunteers to come, but really coordinating it all in the far rock, somewhere in the Rockaways. And he specifically wants to show that he's a libertarian or something, that we don't need government. So what do you think this incredible effort by Occupy, what will that show?
People ask me, well, how is it that, Occupy is now doing Sandy relief? And I think Occupy, since the beginning, has been doing disaster relief. It was doing disaster relief of the financial crisis, right? And getting people involved again in politics beyond electoral politics, right? In terms of direct action on the streets and organizing in their communities. I think there is room for people to do autonomous action, right? And this aid relief effort is an autonomous action, right? What Occupy represents, perhaps, is a kind of new paradigm shift that shows that you don't necessarily always need this top-down approach towards relief and just community organizing more generally, right? So I think, if anything, government should learn from, institutional charity organizations and NGOs should learn from this approach, right, if they want to be more effective.
That was Pablo Benson Silva, a volunteer with the Occupy Wall Street Hurricane Sandy relief effort. For more information on Occupy's relief efforts, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.